www.radiotasmania.org.nz.
Good afternoon, gardeners. You're listening to Garden Planet with Selena and Karen.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Now, today we are going way back in time to the very first gardens made in New Zealand. And we are going to be talking about the history of gardening, and we'll see how far we get in this episode.
Well, we have actually touched on the history of gardening before from a world perspective. But we sort of ran out of time. We were
so gardening.
We're
continued.
So overambitious, aren't we? So we've broken it up, and we're going to look at specifically New Zealand gardening, well, the history of today. And I love history.
Yeah.
Do you?
It's always. I'm a book person, so.
Yeah.
There's always stuff to find out.
I'm going, oh, this is so much work, Selena. You know, you're such a bad producer. How can you do this to me? But in actual fact, I just dig it myself. Like, I really enjoy it, Selena. It's awesome.
Okay.
I've actually learned a lot right from the very first, before the Europeans arrived.
Yep.
Days. What did you learn from your
back and digging
studies?
The past is quite interesting. 800 BC apparently was the time the Maori came in their wakas.
Yeah.
And they arrived in the land of the long white cloud.
Yeah.
And they took with them some plants.
Some.
Well,
what?
My list here says kumara, taro and gourd.
I was definitely going to say those three.
And
I wondered if they brought the cabbage tree with them.
No, that was already here.
Yeah. That's where my studies sort of breaking off into that. Said, oh, did they bring that? And then 2.5 hours later,
they also brought breadfruit, which is a tropical one that cannot grow here because it was too cold.
What fruit was that?
Breadfruit.
Bread?
Breadfruit.
Oh.
A tropical plant. Similar to...
So, does it look like a loaf of bread hanging in the tree?
I think it's just a staple of the Pacific diet.
Okay.
I have heard of that.
Wait, so they're in the islands?
Yeah, in the islands.
Still today?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask some of the students. So I work with a lot of island students.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask them about that.
So we couldn't grow coconuts or anything either. It was just way too cold. So those three, kumara, taro and gourds, were the treasures that they brought over.
We still can't grow coconuts.
Not really, no.
Okay. So, yeah, interesting.
And when they came here, they must have seen how green and lush it was. Quite different from the tropics, though. So,
yeah.
Yep. And so they thought, well, let's
see what we can do with this beautiful, fertile, subtropical land. So the European explorers that first saw, you know, the land of the long white cloud and that beneath it, they observed that the Maori people had neatly organised communal gardens up to 5 hectares in size. That's about 3.5 soccer fields. It's quite a sizable veggie plot.
Yeah.
On sunny north-facing slopes. And karaka trees were often planted near settlements for their fruit.
Yes. Yep.
So that was their first observations. I found out how the Maori prepared the land, which was quite interesting.
Oh, tell us.
Well, they'd burn the forest down. Not all of it, obviously. What the bit they needed. And then they would spread the soil with the ash and then some sand.
Okay.
And if the soil was a heavy sort of clayish soil, they would add gravel. And the land was not completely dug over or hoed up like the settlers would do. They would just form it into small earth mounds. So that's how they would do it. They used hardwood tools mm-hmm. often made of kanuka, which is like a real hardwood native. And they used to poke and prod the soil rather than turn over clods.
Yes.
So that's kind of my style of gardening, actually. I'm sort of the no dig, no back breaking sort of style.
Well, they didn't have spades, so they used sticks.
My readings, even when the Europeans brought all their tools over, the Maori people were still like,
I'd rather use digging sticks. Yeah,
and their gardens were used for about 2 to 6 years, and then left fallow for several years, during which time a cover of fast-growing native shrubs would develop over the top, and then they would go and look for another patch. That's how they operated. They didn't learn. They didn't use animal manure so much, or at all.
Oh, okay,
it was the European settlers that introduced them to that sort of fertilising, so that you could keep using the land.
Oh, and, okay. How about their pigs? I thought they brought pigs over.
I think so. I don't think pigs were here.
Then,
so they brought livestock over, like goats and horses and
the rats. Or was that no?
Probably. The Europeans brought a lot over. That was another part of my studies that I discovered. And some of it, was just ridiculous.
I'm just thinking that you don't really use pig manure as fertilizer for gardens.
I don't know. I've never thought about it.
Well, you use
I know you do. I use chicken manure and I feed them all things from the food pyramid. Meat and they love what I've discovered about chickens, just a quick aside lately, is they love raw fish, because Pierre's been catching quite a bit of snapper on his ski and bringing it back, and I thought, poor me, what am I going to do with all this fresh snapper? And so chickens eat meat, raw meat. I love it.
Karen, did you find out if the
raw steak,
if the Maori used seaweed as fertilizer?
Oh, what did you discover on
that?
Find much about seaweed use, but I reckon they would have. I know they used it a lot and they ate it.
Yeah, as coringa. So it was so abundant, or still
is. And they used it to wrap.
So you'd think maybe.
Well, I would assume they would have.
Yeah.
And interestingly, pre-European gardens were not plagued with weeds. Apparently so. I got this information from Tiara.
Okay, very good.
New Zealand Encyclopedia, if you're wondering. Because the New Zealand flora at that time didn't include weedy annuals or biennials.
Of course. It was, they call it pristine. Well, I wouldn't say it was pristine, but it was endemic, meaning all the plants that were here already were not found anywhere else. So all that was introduced by man.
Oh, okay. So what about the plant? Well, you're talking about the white man? No, hang on. Oh, so the Polynesians, but there were plants here before the Polynesians.
Yeah, of course. It wasn't a treeless space.
Yes.
It was all what I suppose God planted already.
Yeah. So a lot of the, I think, edibles that we find today, the kumara.
Yeah.
The potato.
Yes.
All those
have
common...
been introduced.
Yeah, have been, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The settlers brought over lots of seedlings with them.
Well, they wanted to find out what could grow, but they also, when the Europeans came, they came to explore the land and find out the new plants New Zealand had.
Yes, that was another really interesting fact.
Bring back to, say, England or Europe to see if it would grow in their climate.
There was an exchange, and it was quite interesting reading up on just the interactions that the Maoris and the settlers had they around food.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Quite remarkable.
Would you like some of this? Oh, I've never seen it before.
You hear about all the sort of land wars and these sort of things, and you don't hear so much about what brings people together, which is more often than not food.
Exactly. So Joseph Banks was the director of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, England, and he financed an expedition with the botanist Dr. Solander in 1770 to go and find these new plants from Australia and New Zealand. So that was one of the main purposes of coming to New Zealand, so they could find these new plants. So it's quite amazing that, the history is all tied up with plants. Back then they had a new invention called the Wardian case, which is basically a little glass house where you can keep plants in so that they could be shipped back without dying.
I was wondering how they managed that, because I'm thinking I can barely keep my seedlings alive on the deck, you know, let alone on a ship 6 months from land, you know.
Can you imagine how long they had to be kept alive until they got back to where they were from? So that helped in a lot of exchanging plants across the sea in different areas.
So
that's how they were doing it. And they had plant hunting people especially sent to find out, what is this new plant? Will it grow back in England?
So once, and then of course, post-discovery, then, you've got your European settlers that started flooding in. And what along with them came what they called the pioneer nurserymen. And these people arrived with the first influx of settlers in the 1840s, coincidentally around the time the treaty was signed. So I wonder, when did they first, when did they first discover New Zealand? What year was that? Do you know? Can you remember? Definitely before 1840, but...
Well, my date says 1770.
I was going to say close to 1800.
On the voyage.
So we're looking at about 70 years later, then people really started coming thick and fast. They quickly set up businesses importing, these are the pioneer nurserymen, importing, propagating and selling plants that the developing colony needed. And within just a few years, these nurserymen had grafted tens of thousands of fruit trees, raised hundreds of thousands of conifer and gum tree for shelter, and produced countless shrubs of gorse. And I think there's some other things that they...
I had gorse on here circled going, yes, they brought gorse and they thought it would make a good hedge, but then it got out and spread everywhere.
Interesting.
As well as blackberry.
Yes, but I do like blackberries, but they can be a nuisance on the farm, that's for sure.
I have here that the Europeans were collecting flax, our native flax, and very useful in those days because they used it to make rope. They did not have synthetics, and that was a big export business.
Oh, yeah. Flax?
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, I wanted to just talk about up until the Second World War. We're about halfway through, guys, so bear with us if you're not into history. It's worth knowing. The coastal Maori tribes, speaking of enterprise, would often sell their vegetables to the whalers and the sealers and the first European settlers because they arrived with nothing. And they needed to eat. So the Maori people... were doing quite well profit-wise of this.
They had
until they were able to set up their own gardens and get them established and whatnot. So that was quite interesting. They weren't silly and they did work together. Until the Second World War, did you want to add to that?
I'm just mentioning the Maori land wars or the European and Maori land wars, how the... It is a sad part of our history and not really talked about much because the Maori did cede some of their land and the Europeans started taking over. And that affects how we have a lot of land today that is settlement for Europeans to make cities.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, like, Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch, all that land was taken. So, it could set up a colony and brought all their plants over and started just growing everything.
That they wanted to.
Yeah.
And doing things their way.
Yeah.
There was, so upon the arrival of the white man, some of these people, these settlers, they accumulated a lot of money very quickly through land and, you know, whatnot. And, you know, enterprise off that land. So they would display their affluence by building mansions surrounded by landscaped gardens. Just getting it back to the gardening.
Yeah.
And this was usually on the eastern sides of the North and South Islands on vast estates of sheep run.
So you had your homestead
type situation.
Vast estate and all this land for your sheep. You cut down all the forest. And then you could create a garden around your manor.
Yeah, beautiful gardens too. Yeah.
And they're still...
some of them are still...
Yeah, they're still being gardened today.
Yeah. And I must say, you know, coming from the Waikato, coming from a rural background, you still have the odd person that's growing up with land or they're now, you know, multiple farm owners and, you know... It's been in the family probably since those days, and some and often you'll see, you know, the grandmother's home.
Yes,
the gardens are just mind blowing. Yeah. You know, that's what they do all the time, and it's beautiful. A lot of space.
They were following the English country garden style of gardening at the time, which is hedges, lawns, borders of flowers, and
roses,
oak trees,
arches,
style of gardening.
Yeah, ornamental style, lovely. Yeah. Anyway, so until the Second World War, getting away from the affluent a bit, well, they're included, I suppose, gardens, whether they were huge or small, were the key source of the household's fruit and vegetables and food.
Yep. First source of nourishment was
Every suburban backyard had a vegetable garden, fruit trees, a shed, an outside toilet, an outside clothesline. Don't often see those anymore because everyone just gets the clothes horse things. And compost bins. Almost every backyard looked like that. Now, that's what I've got. I've got all those things, although not a garden shed. I wouldn't mind my own garden shed.
No, I don't.
Did you hear that, Pia?
Neither.
I wouldn't mind some more fruit trees, but, I'm kind of like the the unique sort of
you're the beneficiary
hipster
of those suburban type
whereas
gardens.
This was, I was normal once upon a time.
It was at a quarter acre section that was the norm.
Do have quite a large section. I don't know if it'd be quarter acre, but that was the norm. And then as fruit and vegetables became relatively cheaper to buy, the household gardens became less focused on growing food and more focused on recreation.
Okay.
So that's how, it began.
At that era of gardening, that it was originally the domain of men. The men would grow the veggies and the women would grow the flowers.
That gender
divide.
I read that the children are a lot more involved in the garden too, so it would be their job to water it and they would be helping out a lot more. Now, how many kids do you want to see in the garden? They're just like, I get my hands dirty.
Going the other way now, but back then,
it's
funny
awesome,
how times change.
Post-World War II, gardens, you know, around this, you know, suburban garden was a common thing now. They were more about formality and show rather than, you know, survival.
As people got more affluent.
And flowering plants from overseas became a lot more common.
Yes, they would get ornamentals like magnolias, camellias and rhododendrons and...
Lilies.
Yeah. Big trade in that, so...
Interesting. And I have all these little garden groups everywhere. you know, sourcing the newest and latest, you know, bulb or it was like a big deal.
If you want to see that type of garden in Auckland that is still in that era, so if you go to Epsom, there's a lot of gardens that were started in that era that reflect that. So that
Epsom's one of the older suburbs of
Auckland. Eden Garden by Mount Eden, Government House, which is sort of on the border of Mount Eden and Epsom.
Was that house that we went to for that dress up?
Oh, Alberton.
Oh, yes. That looks like quite a traditional one.
Yes, a bit earlier than that, but the Epsom used to be the fruit, not the fruit bowl, but the wheat. It used to provide the food for everyone in Auckland before it expanded
to Pukekohe.
Yeah. But did you know that Auckland was originally treeless?
I have seen images of Auckland in that time. Yeah, I was blown away. It was like just a vast sort of tussocky, I don't know if that was the right grass, but I was like, where's all the bush?
So we did not have bush.
So went Waitakere's foothills and then just
kind of a grassy area.
Land. Yeah.
So all the trees that you see around Auckland today are planted.
Oh, beautiful. And we can do it.
Yeah. And one of the first parks, so there's three main parks really, Cornwall Park, Auckland Domain, Albert Park, around that time.
Mm.
They were set aside or given to the citizens of Auckland for recreational purposes and planted up. And in the Domain, they had greenhouses, they still have them, to grow all the plants needed for the gardens.
So they were actually used to supply the public with...
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And there was a society called the Auckland Acclimatization Society that bring over all these plants from Europe or China or wherever.
Yeah.
And even birds like sparrows. And such, just to make it all familiar to the settlers. And they would try to grow them here and then send them out.
So isn't it funny how they say...
I know.
Acclimatization, what was it, society or something? Yeah. Yet that's not actually, they're not acclimatizing to here. They're just bringing their world here.
Yeah. But they had to put a stop to some of them because some of those plants got out of hand.
Oh, yeah, you don't say.
And so that's why we have MAF or biosecurity now.
Established. Yeah. So a typical large vegetable garden for those people that were still, I think that's one third of society by now was still, you know, big on the producing your own produce.
Mm-hmm.
They were divided into at least four beds, separated by gravel paths, and the crops were rotated. Gardeners with limited access to animal manure maintained their soil by digging in green crops. And then making compost was promoted during the 1940s and generally accepted as good practice by most home gardeners. So that was that.
Karen, are we going to go into the 1950s when people started gardening with chemicals and insecticides?
I was not going to.
I didn't really want to mention that.
But they did. Yeah. But,
unfortunately.
I did mention it briefly. Where was that?
It became quite mechanical. And
the whole...
It was the new wave of...
I wrote it somewhere.
Modernisation.
Yeah, that's how we managed to get cheaper produce was through the use of these techniques.
And
that's why they are applied today, because, thinking from a short-sighted point of view, it is quicker, easier, cheaper. They can produce more for less. And the people go, woohoo! And
I think it was partly to do with the baby boom after the war. The population was devastated, so they just needed everything quickly. And science was going to save the day.
Gardening is not easy. It is is not easy. And, you know, there are times when I have to go to the shop because my garden is not performing and doing what I want it to. And I can't afford to go to Palmer's and go and stock up on, you know. It's unfortunate. It's weird. But I think that that's slowly starting to change, that attitude.
For me, when I read about this history, I think, wow, that world war must have been so devastating that half the population was dead and the men, you know, we had to carry on.
Mm.
And so that has reflected on how we grow things today.
I'm so glad that you brought it up to, that part in history. Did you learn about the Dig for Victory campaign?
Yes.
Were you going to just talk about that now?
I'll let you.
So during the Second World War, there was a vegetable shortage, and this was because a lot of the market gardeners and home gardeners were entering the armed forces, and also because a lot of the remaining produce was sent away
to
supply the armed forces. So the government launched a Dig for Victory campaign in 1943, exhorting householders to grow vegetables and encouraging families to eat a healthy diet. Lawns were dug up and planted in vegetables. And then also children grew vegetables in their school grounds, and Auckland and Wellington City Councils provided public land for garden allotments. So this was actually the first community gardens were happening. And it really only happened because it had to. The people were going hungry. It can be done, and it shows you that the government, you know, can push for people to, you know, or allow time and space for people to do that.
Yeah.
That's the limiting things today, time and space.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't even have a lawn anymore.
No. And a lot of those big gardens, quarter acre sections, have been subdivided up.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's, I mean, apartment living's more and more and more common. You're lucky if you find a pot plant in anyone's, you know. And if that is, it's probably plastic.
Yes, I've seen them in Kmart.
They do look nice. Okay, I've got a few.
Just brushing head a bit, just fast forwarding a bit.
Yes, because we're counting down.
Okay, so after this whole chemical revolution of fast
and mechanical
gardening, and mechanical and industrial, there was a bit of a backlash in the 1970s, and they realised that a lot of it was affecting the land, and
they knew that in the 70s.
Yeah, there was a whole so the conservation movement started up, and they realised, oh, we can't just remove all the native bush and just use all these fertilizers that are damaging the soil. And so the organics movement started being visible.
Yeah.
So
awesome.
As a kind of reaction to what was happening. So, yeah. And that's come to today where we're still kind of reacting against what happened.
Well, but I heard that New Zealand's one of, I don't know how many countries that are still allowing the use of glyphosate, which I think is appalling when you think other countries have taken the charge and said no more, banned.
Yes.
Bit embarrassing.
I know.
Yeah.
We still deal with it today in our community garden. Anyway, so we
hope we've enlightened you guys a bit with New Zealand's gardening history. I certainly was. I enjoyed my, it was a long journey. It always is with history, you know, there's a lot to sort through.
Yes.
But a fun journey nonetheless, and very interesting, I thought so. So.
Yeah, thanks, Karen. It's, wonderful to discover or rediscover the history of
it. Yeah, and how cyclic it is too.
Mm.
Yeah. Let's hope for those more of those communal gardens.
Okay. Well, happy gardening, everyone.
Okay. Take care, guys.
Bye. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. That's all we have time for. Come back next week for more great gardening tips at Garden Planet. You can find us on Facebook on our Garden Planet Facebook page, or email us at gardenplanetfm@gmail.com if you want to ask us anything about gardening. Happy gardening, everyone, and we'll be back next week.